You are listening to Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. And welcome to another edition of our monthly radio book club. It is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. As always, Arsene Kashkashian, head buyer of the bookstore, is joining us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Maeve.
And this is a theme we established last month with Laura Pritchett. We have a second returning author. We had Laird Hunt join us early on in the book club for his book Never Home. Laird's new book is The Evening Road, and that's been this month's selection.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying kind of doing these second books by people. You get to see connections between their previous work. And we've got some great writers in Colorado, and it's just fun to follow their careers. And so I'm really happy to have Laird Hunt here for a second book.
Well, Laird, welcome to the studio.
It's great to be back.
So, Laird, you're here today with your book, The Evening Road. And we did Never Home. Never Home, you told it from a woman's perspective who was fighting in the Civil War. Now we've moved up about 70 years, and we are at a lynching in 1930, Indiana. And you tell the story basically from two perspectives, a white woman and African-American woman. And I guess I kind of wondered, I was reading it, it seems like these historic women are coming through you. What, you know, what was your thought process, or you just hear, you almost told me with Never Home that you heard that voice coming, that first line, and then followed from that. Was it a similar experience with this, or was it something different?
Because you mentioned Never Home, it's worth noting that in the middle, very middle of that book, there is a scene that's really important to me in which the main character of Never Home, Ash Thompson, encounters an African-American woman on the road who has also disguised herself as a man and is returning from combat as Ash is. And for a little while, they walk along the road together. But it becomes very quickly apparent that they're not going to be sharing the road. So they're on the same road, but they're not going to walk along together along it. And so that's in the 1860s. And in a sense, the Evening Road comes out of that moment. So two women on the road, but for very different reasons on the night of this lynching in Marion, Indiana, which I have fictionalized as Marvel, Indiana.
Why don't you tell us about the two women? You have a white woman, Audie Lee, and then you have a black girl, really, 16, Calla Destry. Why don't you give us just a little overview of who those two women are and how do they find themselves on this day?
Sure. So Audie Lee is the first voice I wrote, and for a long time, she was the Evening Road, her story of that night. And so she is a secretary, married, working for a lecherous, highly problematic boss who one day says to her, grab your things, there's a lynching over in Marvel, and we're going to go attend it. And this was based on the stories that came out of the many thousands of people who poured into Marion, Indiana for the infamous lynching that gave provided the inspiration for the song Strange Fruit that was first a poem by Abel Meeropol and then made famous as a song by Billie Holiday. Thousands of people went to the event, and there's a photograph that came out of that lynching of these two young men, Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith, of white people looking up at these two young men who have been brutally killed and smiling. And so I was intrigued by this idea of what would it be like to get inside the mind of someone who had decided to go along, who hadn't said, you know what, I want to go, but she had accepted this invitation to go and wants to in many ways, but also it becomes problematic as well as she goes. So that was the story for a long time, her difficulty, their difficulty in getting to the lynching. And it sat that way for a long time. And then I realized that it just wasn't possible that there was one voice to talk about this. There had to be another voice, someone who was leaving. Almost as soon as that thought came into my mind, the voice of Calla Destry began speaking. And so she is this, as you say, a teenager, who is desperate to get out of town, and yet finds all kinds of barriers in her way, some self-created as well.
Well, it's interesting. Their story's parallel because Audie Lee has all sorts of barriers in getting to the lynching, And Caladestri has all sorts of barriers in getting away. And so ultimately, it feels like this book is the tale of two journeys rather than the actual event itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So the event is meant to sit as a kind of dark vortex at the center of this. And there's a dreamlike quality to, I think, both of the stories. I hope not overdetermined, but it's there. And one of those dreams in which you're trying to get somewhere and there keep being barriers thrown up in front of you. I think a lot of us can relate to those. I have all sorts of permutations on that dream. And they're telling their stories years later, and I suppose that's creeping into it as well, the barriers, the impediments of memory, of describing it correctly, of deciding what you think about this. And sometimes you have to tell a whole story to arrive at how you feel about something. At least that's been my experience. And this is what they're doing in a sense.
The lynching, as you said, is really the kind of dark vortex at the center of this. And yet you never actually describe the lynching itself. For Ottie Lee, her story is the journey trying to get there. And as Arson said, for Calla, her journey is trying to get away from it. But we never witness, as a reader, the lynching. And yet the horror of it is really part of the story because of that festive atmosphere that is all over Marvel and all these people trying to get to this event. That, to me, was a very interesting way of describing such a horrific act, this lynching, through how people, you know, saw it as a party, as something to be celebrated, and children were going, and it was this kind of carnival-type atmosphere. The you know, the paradox of those two things being together in the same event, I found very disturbing, you know, and a very interesting way to describe a lynching.
Mm. You know, For me, the fact that there was this iconic photograph that circulated at the time nationally as a picture postcard, which is just it's shocking to consider, and yet it's reality, and it's one of those images of a lynching that haunts the minds of so many of us. It's easily available on the internet, etc. And so I realized that there wasn't going to be any more devastating way to recreate that event in the pages of this book. And yet what I could do was talk about, just as you say, the reaction, the aftershock, the sort of the malevolent undercurrent that's riding along the roads of the county on that day and on that night. And so that's where I focused. There is a moment in the book where we have a description by Calla of the actual of the lynching, of what leads up to the lynching, and yet she never witnesses it. This is just something that haunts her. She's read newspaper accounts of the event, and she's remembering it so vividly that it feels as if she was there. And that's kind of what I was trying to capture.
Well, I think you certainly do capture that. I mean, somehow the book, the indelible image is almost a lynching, which you don't actually see in the book, but in your mind, the after effect of the book is that, and you can't get away from that. I wanted you to read a passage, which is a Calla, and it's her version of kind of a lynching. Maybe you could set this up for us a little bit. This is Calla at the courthouse while people are gathering for the lynching, and she's going to do something that I thought was a very interesting comment on what was happening in the community.
So Calla has driven around the courthouse square and seen people milling ahead of the event in this sort of this festive party atmosphere, almost as if the carnival has come to town. She's horrified by this. She knows very, very well what's going to happen, and she knows she should get out of town as quickly as possible. Instead, she sneaks into the courthouse, which is emptied out, and climbs to the top and finds herself in a room full of flags, state flags that have been stored there. And she's visited before played in this, what she refers to as a flag forest. And she gets this idea for a kind of act of defiance. And this is the passage where she describes her idea and what she does. "My idea, if you can call it that when you are 16 and storm-bent on something you haven't thought halfway through, in making that climb had been a small one. Maybe throw something out the window and see what it hit. But it grew bigger as I cast my eyes down. Saw how many of them there were. Every last one of them ready to break down the jailhouse door. do a dance under that bloody shirt, get quick as they could to the killing to come. I'd give them something else they could do their devil dancing to. It didn't take a minute to retrieve the frizzlehead mop I'd seen on the stairs and find some rope. It was harder than I liked getting the great state flag of Indiana off its floor stand, though, and I wished more than once as I yanked and tugged that I had a good pair of scissors or a knife. Still, I did get it off more or less intact, and then fixed it tight around the mop handle, so that it looked like a robe or dress around a dead creature. Creature of the state flag forest. I got the rope snug around her neck, and hung the whole thing out the window. Then I took a deep breath, called out, banged hard on the window frame, and laughed good and loud and long at what I had done.
Yeah, so she's mirroring the lynching by hanging the state flag, which is just a wonderful comment. And I also thought it was wonderful, she's in this room with all the state flags. Like, the whole country is complicit in this. And I thought that was an interesting way to frame it. And I felt very powerful. Mm. And I thought that this act was kind of amazing. And then she's got to get out of there, too. So, you know, how did you... What was the impetus for that? I mean, did anything like this really happen? Probably not, right? So you wanted to really... She's a powerful 16-year-old, this girl.
Yeah, well, I've certainly met many 16-year-olds who are... have that sense at the one, you know, on the one hand, she's absolutely registering the mortal danger that she is in. On the other hand, she's unwilling to let it go, and finds herself doing something that will stay with her throughout the rest of this experience. Indeed, this she'll find that this flag that she's hung out the window returns to her in the way that the violence returns to her, and so her journey with it will continue. But I have been in a room full of state flags being stored and found a strange, quiet beauty in that. And that image returning to me, though, in this kind of context, seemed like anything but calm and beautiful.
We're speaking this morning with author Laird Hunt about his new book, The Evening Road. You're listening to KGNU and our Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, and my co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. This is Laird's second trip to the book club. He joined us early on with his book, Never Home, and his latest book, The Evening Road, is what we're reading this month in April. Laird, there are a lot of parallels I found with Never Home. One of them being it's you're writing from a female perspective and from a very historic perspective. This time, this is in 1920. And also the journey. Everyone is on a journey and they encounter almost like a, kind of a James Joycean Ulysses type thing. They encounter these incredible characters and have these incredible encounters and adventures on this journey. And so we have two characters on separate journeys whose journeys actually intersect at different points. Is that something that you just find just wonderful fodder for storytelling? When somebody's on a journey, you have this opportunity to introduce characters and encounters that you otherwise maybe couldn't do.
Yeah, you know, it's the great fraught, challenging American story in a way, which involves moving down a road and encountering things and other people, and intersecting and exchanging, and in some cases fighting, colliding. And for me, starting with the novel Kind One, and then moving through Never Home and into The Evening Road, everyone is in motion. Almost constantly. And when they're not, something's wrong, in a way. Even when the characters in The Evening Road are resting, sitting down under a tree, they break into arguments. They start to squabble. It's a kind of fraught safety to be in motion. At least you're not going to be where you just were. You don't know what you're going to encounter, though.
And because this is two journeys, in Never Home it was one journey, it was Ash. This is two different journeys, Calla and Ottie Lee. And as I said, their journeys intersect or they come across the same characters at different points. Logistically, was that more of a challenge? And how do you keep track of all of that to make sure the timeline is working and that these characters would be at that same point at a certain time?
Yeah, I made diagrams and tried to make sure that things were more or less synced up, but also remembering that, again, both of these stories are being told some years later. We don't know exactly under what circumstances, but there are the vagaries of memory within that. And so there are some things that perhaps don't quite sync up, but I think overall they do. And I will say that in the early draft, or early drafts, because there are quite a number of them, of the book, there were more parallels. The stories mirrored each other more. And that was one of the realizations I had, was that these couldn't be mirror images of each other. I didn't want to then say, okay, now here's my version of what happened that you just described. I want it to be stories, as you say, that intersect, but that don't explain each other in a way. They inform each other, but they don't explain each other, because there's no reason why they would.
You tell Adi Lee's story first, about, you know, half the book, or maybe slightly less, and then you tell Caladestri's story next. And I was wondering if you had ever played with intersecting or alternating them, but then decided you wanted to do them as a full piece. And what advantages did that have for you telling this story? And maybe what disadvantages does it create?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a conversation actually with an important early reader about that exactly. So the stories came as their own entities. But then the question was, in terms of structuring the book, should we do that thing where we go back and forth? And I said it with a little bit of a lack of enthusiasm in my voice, and it was met with a sort of lack of enthusiasm about the idea, because we'd seen it so many times, this idea of going back and forth in a kind of predictable way. And so there was this sense of sinking deep, swimming deeply in the story, and then going into another one afterwards, at the end of this long swim. And certainly it's the case that gives a different kind of rhythm to the book, gives it a different kind of speed. And I think people who get very excited about Adi Lee's story, when they register that we're never going back to it, there is a dip. What I'm hoping, though, is that once the voice of Caladestri begins to engage, that Adi Lee is like, okay, I can live without this now.
But you sorry, Arson.
I think that was my exact experience, actually. I think I was a little disappointed to leave Adi Lee. And it did take me maybe 10 pages into Caladestri to really recover from that. And then it's just a delight when Caladestri sees Adi Lee from a distance at one point. You really appreciate that.
But you actually end the book with a third voice who is introduced in Adi Lee's story. Why that? This is the angel runner, and this is a lady who's actually one of the voices in the book who is against the lynching, and she's going to a Quaker meeting, a prayer meeting. And why did you end with a completely different character?
Well, so there is this third character, and she was present, and in many ways more present in the early drafts of the book. She had a role to play also in Caladestri's story when I first drafted it. That's maybe more backstory information than one needs, but just to say that this is a character who's very important. Sally Gunner is her name, and I wanted her not to have a sort of summarizing role at the end, but this idea in her fairly brief section of pointing to us that the story hasn't been completed. The story is continuing, that there are other voices. If you have two, there's this implication that we've locked it down. We have this nice, neat entity. But if we have three, maybe that means there are four and five and six. So the idea with that is to point towards multiplicity, because there were so many voices that night, and so many experiences, as there always are. So I'm always interested in ways to just push it a little bit farther.
You made a decision in this book to not use the words really white, black, the N-word, which probably was used much that night in real life. And you used words like cornflower, corn silk, corn root. I guess maybe tell us, what was the genesis of that? What do you think it serves in the book? And I guess, you know, why you did it ultimately.
Yeah, sure. So there are different ways to go after that question, or answering that question. And one of them is that the book diverges in many ways from the events of the actual night. And that was really important to me. I drew on the work of historians, someone like James Madison and his seminal work about that, the actual night, a lynching in the heartland, and then, of course, read the journal of the third person that night who was supposed to be lynched, someone who was quite young, a teenager, James Cameron was his name, and he left, he wrote a memoir about it some years later, which is quite extraordinary, called A Time of Terror. So it felt like the facts of the matter had been covered by them and by other writers. And I wanted to diverge and make it very clear that I wasn't trying to do history about that night, that it was something a little bit more universal and also a creature of memory and storytelling, as I've already alluded to. And so there are things that occur in the novel that absolutely didn't occur that night. And then there are aspects of fever dream. There is a hallucinatory episode in a nightmarish beauty parlor, for example. There's a gigantic pig. And so there are all these things that say this isn't quite the world as we know it. And another one of those elements is what you refer to, the use of this different terminology to refer to race, ethnicity, etc. within the novel. And so it's, you know, that's one way to refer to it, is that it is speaking to this alt-world ontology of this universe. This isn't exactly Earth as we know it, even though it's not meant to be some completely fantastical description or depiction. And then also it goes to the initial drafting of that story, Audie Lee Henshaw's story, in which the words, the racial epithets of the time appear. I have the draft. I printed it out some time ago, and I look at it occasionally. And it has all of those, all of that terminology that would have been in use. And it was very slender. And I realized what was happening with my imagination was that those words on the page were so loud, so heavy, so weighty, that it felt hard to see the way forward, in a sense. Which is instructive and informative, but I knew that there was more story to tell. And I thought, well, what happens if we don't have those words? And I did some intermediary euphemisms, and then I moved to this other terminology that's so different. And it indeed allowed the book to open into all different kinds of directions.
One thing I like about the terminology you picked, and I was thinking about this, was it's corn flour, corn silk, corn root, but each ethnicity, each racial group starts with the word corn, mm-hmm. because we're people first. Everybody has more in common, really, than they have difference. We focus on the flower and the silk and the root, but the truth is we're all corn. And I thought that's how I read it, and I thought that was very interesting. And the other thing, what you said about maybe stopping you or the word becoming too big on the page is, you know, I love Faulkner. But you read Intruder in the Dust, which I read last year, which is about a lynching that's averted. But, you know, the N-word is on the page a lot. And to modern readers, that's tough, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there's a trade-off, and people have commented on this in the context of this book. There is that question of authenticity and what people would have been saying on that moment. And I say, yes, read Faulkner, read Cormac McCarthy, read so many other writers. That is absolutely one way to do it. But what happens if you want other things in this story to be thought about? Maybe there's some strategy so that those things can be accessed instead of going for a line-by-line faithfulness in that sense. Maybe you can get at a deeper truth by taking this other direction. And what you say about the linkage, the corn being repeated throughout all these terms, that's also, I think, absolutely crucial to underline without trying to make it to softball these very difficult issues. I think it's absolutely legitimate to think about it in those terms.
We're speaking with author Laird Hunt this morning on the Radio Book Club. It's a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore, as always my co-host. And this is Laird's second visit to the book club. His first book, Never Home, was an early selection. And we're reading The Evening Road, which is his latest book. And it centres around a lynching that happened, a real life lynching that happened in 1920. But it's been fictionalised and told from the perspectives of two women who were in that area on that night. You mentioned some of the books that you read. Did you go to Indiana? Did you do a lot of research about lynching in general?
Yeah. So I returned to Indiana a number of times. I mean, one of the reasons I got interested in this particular writing a novel around this particular subject was that Marion, Indiana, where this infamous lynching occurred, is just about an hour away from the family farm in Indiana. And all the years that I lived there, I did a important part of my growing up in rural Indiana. I never heard it mentioned. And as I said, thousands and thousands of people went in that night, and it was, you know, an event that was people were aware of around the country, if not around the world. And so that struck me, and it made me curious. It's not that I felt that there was some big cover-up, but why do some aspects of history just fall away? Why aren't they talked about? Why don't we hear about them, especially in the area where they occurred? And so that got me really interested to go and investigate. And I spent time in the archive at the Marion Public Library that one person has put together of transcripts of the sort of sham trials that occurred in the wake of the event. No one was ever convicted, as is all too often the case. With this sort of event, and the newspaper articles and relevant articles leading up to the moment that paint a very compelling picture. I managed to get into the jail. So it's this extraordinary structure that looks a little like a medieval castle. It has turrets with gargoyles, very strange hulking structure where these young men were kept after they were arrested. In the 80s, it was turned into condominiums, which is very strange. And, you know, so these decades later, it's perhaps run down. Things have gotten a little run down. And I found a way to enter the building and discovered that the iron bars are still in place in the hallways, and the original floors are still there. And so there's a kind of odd jailhouse chic that's gone to seed. It's very haunting. I heard a tinny radio down one corridor, and that was it. So just to say that I felt it really important to go and be in these places and think about them. There's no reference anywhere in the courthouse square, even though, of course, it's covered in memorial plaques and things. There's no mention of it. You can sort of understand that. But then I did lots of driving on the roads between, you know, the farm and Marion. And that was maybe the most important part of the research, was smelling those familiar smells and seeing the familiar sights and hearing the sounds of the different kinds of insects and birds and things.
Is the tree still there?
No, there is, though, a maple tree that's grown up in the time, but that tree was cut down quite some time ago. But I have photographs. As a matter of fact, the original manuscript had a photograph that I took on the courthouse square of the maple tree that's approximately where the tree was before. So there is this haunting quality to it.
Was it cut down because of its history, or was it a completely separate reason?
My understanding is it was just cut down because it had gotten too old.
You know, you wrote this, you know, in the last few years. In the last few years, we've seen all these police killings of black men. And, you know, that's kind of our modern day lynching, basically. It's like it never ends. Were you cognizant of that? Were you thinking you were making a comment? Or you just want to tell the story and let people read it how they read it?
The way all of these books dealing with difficult aspects of history, complicated aspects of the American story, and maybe there are no other type of aspects to the American story in a way, is these voices have come, I've been intrigued by something, the voices have come, and I start the writing, and then I start to think about the resonances with what's going on now. And of course, it was fairly early on in the process of writing The Evening Road that I started to register more and more how little of the fundamentals had changed. And as you say, reading about these young men who were being shot often for, you know, doing next to absolutely nothing, really, was really impacted heavily on my sense of what I was doing with this novel about young men who had not been convicted of any crime, had been accused of a crime, and then were lynched for it. So that, you know, it's this sense of writing about the past, but also in many ways writing about our moment.
Were there ever charges brought up against Cameron, the one who did not get lynched that night in real life? I mean, because the accusations in the book are so vague. You don't really actually ever know what these guys ever did, what the the crime was at the beginning of all this. So the one who lived, who wrote the memoir, can you tell us just a little bit about what happened after that words for him?
So he was convicted of being, I think it was accessory to a crime. What the young men were arrested for was a shooting of a young white man named Claude Dieter. And the circumstances of the shooting, the fact that there was a young woman that was involved and there was some implication of rape, none of it ever substantiated, was enough to have them arrested. And when word got around that this had occurred in that climate, it was enough to stir up this mob. And it was heavily publicized. People came in from all around. And, you know, James Cameron was 16-year-old, a kid who lots of people in town knew. He did shoeshine work at the Interurban Station, and everybody knew him. By all accounts, just a wonderful kid who got caught up with a couple young men who were a little older, and he was going to be lynched as well, and he was actually dragged to the tree. And somehow, though, the fury of the mob was sated, and he was let go. But he was convicted and spent time in jail, and then left Indiana, and for many years didn't go back to Marion. And he founded a museum about African-American history in Milwaukee, did very important social justice work throughout his life. And there was reconciliation is not quite the right word, but he forgave the city of Marion, and he was pardoned by the governor of Indiana at the time. And so it was a sort of extraordinary long life that he lived in the wake of this horrifying event in his youth.
Well, we've been speaking with Laird Hunt this morning on the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. His latest book is The Evening Road. You can find out more information at news.kgnu.org. Laird, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, as we always do at the end of this book club, we always announce our next pick. So the selection for May is another returnee to the book club, Peter Heller, and an exciting opportunity for listeners to come and see this being recorded on April 29th at the Boulder Bookstore. It's Independent Bookseller Day.
Yeah, Independent Bookstore Day. This is the third annual Independent Bookstore Day. It started out in California as California Bookstore Day, and where everybody said, that seems like a good idea. And so this will be the centerpiece. We're going to do the show live in the ballroom. We invite everybody to come. You kind of see how Maeve and I figure things out. Maeve's very smooth. I'll be fumbling with my 3x5 cards, but it should be fun, I think. And then after we do the half-hour interview, we can open it up for questions from the audience.
So Peter Heller's latest book is Celine?
Yes. It's a book loosely based on his mother's life, and it's a novel. And Peter is a lot of fun. He likes to laugh a lot, so I think, you know, if you come, you'll have a good time.
So that's happening Saturday, April 29th at 3 p.m. in the ballroom of the Boulder Bookstore. And it will be broadcast on Thursday, May 25th. And we'll put full details at news.kgnu.org. Arsene Kashkashian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Maeve.
And for KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.